for the beginning, Hal Rothbard is an employee at the university. He's not just an outsider, he's a very good friend of Henry's. All right, I'd like to introduce Henry Bites, who is a very good friend. And basically, Henry is a computer maven. Everything with computers, you call Henry, Henry knows what to do. Henry works at the business school in their computer lab and is the person that everybody calls when there's any problem, and Henry knows what to do and how to solve the problem. But that's not all Henry does. Henry also works with businesses to help them set up their computer programs, particularly databases for businesses. And he also has a few hobbies, and if you'd like to get to know Henry well, you might ask him how he's doing in his progress. So I'd like to welcome Henry
Bice
to the ELI. Thank you, Henry.
Thank you,
Rowan. Well, this presentation really has its origins a long, long way back. The origins of the whole concept really went back to the 1950s, but I won't bother you with too much of the history. I'll just tell you what it is I'm trying to do. Most of my life has been spent solving problems. And many, many years ago, a Polish mathematician and I decided to see if we could formalize this and put some rigor into the whole thing. And to this end, we looked at what was available, and we actually found that there was nothing that would communicate the problem or its solution to the users. So what we did is we evolved a mechanism for ourselves using some quite heavy mathematical techniques, but found that this was no good because it really didn't satisfy the user's needs. And over the years, we adapted things that already existed to our needs. The thing that we're going to use, I'll show you later on, but I'm going to talk about the whole idea of solving problems. Let me first start, though, with some very simple things. When do solutions to problems fail? Well, every time I go in and I work with some group, they'll tell me, oh, that can never happen. Problem solutions fail when things that can never happen do. And believe me, that's much more often than people realize. They also fail when they're just plain omissions, things that were just not considered. And when these things that are not considered arise, then of course the solution fails. Sometimes, erroneously, people decide that given a particular situation, they want to do something, but what they've chosen to do is not appropriate to the solution. This happens. Another one of the problems is contradictions. You'll find that two people interpret something so totally differently that, in fact, if they're have different responsibilities, each will be expecting the other to do something that he didn't understand, or she. Don't want to be a sexist. And then lastly, ambiguities. I have a beautiful case here where two groups working for a very large company interpreted a specification for a particular solution to a problem totally differently. And they couldn't understand why their solution was failing. And I went in and I did nothing more than run the same program with them. And then in breaking the problem solution apart, found that the two groups had interpreted something in perfectly good but different ways. Well, what does a solver have? It's a sadly American trend never to look at what anybody's done before. I don't know why this is, but in my training, the first thing we always did is do an analysis of precedent. What did somebody else do? Did they solve the problem? Is the solution applicable to our problem? Unfortunately, the not invented here syndrome seems to be a very bad one in this country. I deal with it on a daily basis. I had a student walk up to me the other day, show me a tremendous program to do something in a factory, and I said to him, have you ever heard of XYZ? And he said, no. I said, well, there's an international standard that's been in existence for 20 years, and there's a huge body of work that's been out there for 12 years, and you're trying to reinvent the wheel, and all the tools that you need exist already. He couldn't believe me, so I told him what the acronym was, and he went to look at the web, and he said, my God, he said, I had no idea. He's just finished a 6-week project. Well, I've never understood it, and I never will. The other thing is, don't bring people who have no experience in a field in to try and solve a problem in a particular field. I see doctors trying to write computer programs, and I certainly wouldn't like any computer programmer to do surgery on me or prescribe anything, but everybody seems to feel computing is fair game and they're all experts. No, they're not. And that's why we have so many terrible computer systems. Because people who are experts in a field don't go and get somebody who's an expert in computing to show them how to make the solution work. Well, we would hope that people come to the problem with some knowledge of what it is they're trying to do. Ironically, very often, interdisciplinary knowledge is more important than knowledge in a specific discipline. There are thousands of examples of people from a different discipline providing solutions to people in another discipline. You can look at the DNA situation with Crick and Watson. You can look at numerous instances of this kind of thing. I won't bother you with too many of those. Everybody comes to the solving of a problem with a rag bag full of ideas. And that's good. But ironically, to me, the single most important thing is intuition. Now, I can go on at great length about this, and I won't try to go too far, but I'll give you a few examples. Everybody's heard the story about Isaac Newton having an apple fall on his head, and up comes the theory of gravitation. Oh no, no, it's not as simple as that. In fact, Isaac Newton had been worrying about the orbits of planets and trying to describe whether or not he could really find out why they behaved the way they did. The apple was just, so to speak, the last apple that broke the problem's back. What happened was he needed a little stimulus, but had he not been worrying the problem, all the apples in the world would have made absolutely no difference. Archimedes had exactly the same experience. The king, Hero, had come to him and said, look, I gave this goldsmith some gold and I asked him to make a wreath for me to put in someone's grave, and I don't know whether he used all the gold. And Archimedes worried this problem and suddenly one day in his bath realized something about buoyancy. And incidentally, the account of how it all was done has to be wrong because he couldn't have measured with the accuracy that was necessary. There was a much simpler thing that Archimedes did that isn't in the account, but I won't bother you with the details. But Archimedes noticed that when he lowered himself into his bathtub, the water rose. And he also noticed that he felt a lot lighter when he was in the water than when he was out of the water. And from this, he realized that there was something about this that would help him determine whether, in fact, the goldsmith had used all the gold. There are numerous novelists who described a block where they were just looking for that turn of phrase or that idea or something like that, and in a moment when they weren't even thinking about the novel or were relaxing or doing something else, the concept would come to them, the idea would come to them, the phrase would come to them. It was their intuition that was being stimulated by something else or by complete relaxation. It said that Descartes gave us coordinate geometry when he was ill, lying in bed, watching a fly on the ceiling and deciding that if he could describe the position of the fly at every moment in time, he could write an equation that would describe the path of the fly. And so suddenly he came up with the idea of axes, coordinate axes, the x-axis, the y-axis, and plotting everything in terms of the axes. And so he took all this wealth of geometry that existed and turned it into an algebraic discipline. There are two views of exactly the same thing. And to this day, we have Cartesian coordinates because of Descartes watching the fly on the ceiling. There are a number of other examples, and if you all have access to the internet, if you'll go to www.npr.org, National Public Radio, and go to Weekend Edition, Saturday morning, and look at the latest program, the last item is something about math. And in it, Scott Simon interviews a mathematician who tells of a whole lot of these little things, including some of those that I've already told you about. This happened just within the last week, and my better half, Karen, laughed when she heard them describing exactly the same things that I was describing. Well, enough of all this. Let's get on with solving our problems. Well, the mechanism that I'm using to show you how to go about stimulating your intuition is something known as a decision table. And a decision table has a number of different pieces. Oops, I think I lost something. That's okay, we'll get it back. The decision table has this piece over here, which is called the condition stub, and this piece over here, which is called the rule definition. And essentially, all the condition stub and the rule definition do is ask a question and then give an exhaustive set of answers. Now, what do I mean by an exhaustive set of answers? Well, I'll deal with that in a moment. Finally, the light-colored piece at the top here describes the problem space. The piece at the bottom describes what you're going to do given certain conditions. And all they are is actions which you simply describe, and then you check off under what conditions those actions are executed. So, let's look at this again. We have conditions which consist of a question and a set of possible answers. And we have actions, which only require an identifier. Open the door. Throw out the trash. Write a paragraph. It doesn't matter. It's just a descriptive thing that says what the action is that you're going to take. I will deal later on with how these things can be very complex, and I brought some examples of some of my work to show you how these things can be elaborated, but I'll talk about that later. Okay, each condition requires a name to identify it, a brief description of what it is that you're measuring the condition of, and mutually exclusive set of alternatives. And I will explain exactly what I mean. Now, don't be alarmed by some of the mathematics that's going to come. It's all incredibly simple. And if you need an explanation, just ask me, stop me, and we'll explain. So, a condition. Well, the best way to illustrate exactly what a condition is to give you a specific example. I'm going to draw a circle. And that circle is all painted one color, and it's represented in the computer by what are called pixels, picture elements. And each one, there are thousands of them in there, and each one is colored a different color. I'm going to color them. There they are. Well, now what we have to do is we have to try and work out what question we can ask that will give us what we want. So we want an exhaustive, mutually exclusive set of answers. So I'm going to get a question for you. And the question is, what color is the pixel that you've chosen? I'm asking you all to choose a pixel and then tell me what color it is. Well, there are a finite number of answers. Is it red? Is it blue? Is it green? Is it yellow? But that's not exhaustive. It's neither red, nor green, nor yellow, nor blue. Now we've got every pixel covered. All the answers are mutually exclusive, and it's exhaustive. I tell you this because a very large corporation developed a very large program, and they use these same tables. And at some point in my life, I was privy to these tables. They gave me all these tables, and I found them full of holes. They were not complete. They were full of omissions. They had lots of contradictions. They managed to make a very fine product using the tool. But it was a miracle to me that it worked. Now, I will tell you that I shared this technology with a bunch of technicians at the University of Vermont about 25 years ago, and they jumped at it. They have done nothing but design all the components they've been building ever since using this technology, and they come out of it with a tremendously high level of confidence in the success of everything they do. And it's one of my best stories on this whole thing is just how well they've used it. They understood immediately what the value of the whole concept was. Well, what we've now got is every pixel is one of those five colors. We haven't left any of them out. We have an exhaustive partitioning of the pixels in that original black circle. Now, this is the little bit of mathematics I don't want you to get upset about. The problem space is defined as all the alternatives for the first condition combined with all the alternatives for the second condition, and so on for all the conditions. In simple words, it's every possible combination of all the alternatives for every condition. Now, I can tell you that one of the problems I solved about 20 years ago had 2.9 million possible combinations. Now, immediately everybody says, how can you ever consider 2.9 million? Well, actually, it's very simple. In fact, a lot of what we do wouldn't be possible if there weren't huge numbers of these things that didn't really make a difference. And it's identifying them that we have to go about. Okay, so I'm going to show you a very simple problem space in this very abstract way. But don't worry, I'm going to give you something less abstract down the road. So the set of conditions for our problem, there are just two. The first condition and the second condition. Condition one and condition two. And the sets of alternatives, well, for condition one, we'll simply have four alternatives. Alternative one, two, three, and four. And for condition two, we'll have just yes and no. Okay, well, we're going to diagram this now with a decision table. So I've put the whole thing down at the bottom, and I've started off by looking at condition one. And I've said condition one in the condition stub, and in the right-hand side, in the rule definition, I've defined four things, alternatives one, two, three, and four. Now, if you look, our second condition, this one down here, only has a yes and no. Well, that means we've got to have every possible combination. That means we have to have yes and no here, yes and no here, yes and no here, yes and no here, like this. Now, it's an exhaustive. This is the entire problem space. There is nothing more. And we'll name the rules. We'll call them rule 0 through rule 7. Now, it turns out that the beauty of this technique, if you've done it right, is that it doesn't matter in what order you name the conditions or in what order you name the alternatives. So, for instance, we could do this. Here I make condition 2 the first condition, and it's just yes or no, and it partitions the problem space into two pieces. And then within each one, I've put the set of alternatives. Now, if you want to stimulate your intuition, it's very important that you make this a disciplined thing. Don't randomly choose the order. Choose the order and then stick to it. So if you'll notice, for condition 1, I have mixed up the alternatives. So I've got alternative 2, but it's first in both cases. I've got alternative 4, but it's second in both cases. Now, why do we want to do this? I'll tell you why. Because when you've finished with one of these tables, believe it or not, just looking at it, you will see the patterns. And the patterns are going to register with you immediately. And when they register with you, you can say, wow, look at that. It's exactly the same in all these alternatives. And you won't see the patterns if you start mixing up those orders. Well, these are identical. The only difference is that they have a different number. And they've moved around a little bit. But we haven't lost anything. It's still complete. And we're still going to be able to do whatever we need to do. Okay, so let's go about making a simple decision table. Well, I'm going to take our problem, and there's our basic decision table. Now, at the moment, we haven't put in the actions. And it doesn't matter in what order you consider the rules. The beauty of this is that you know that when you finish the whole table, you're going to have considered every rule. That's one of our precepts. We're going to consider every rule, but it doesn't matter in what order we consider them. The beauty of it is that we can block out all the other rules, and we can just concentrate on one of them. And we don't have to worry. I'll tell you very quickly a little aside. I had a young graduate from Berkeley working for me, and we were a group of people who put together a very complex project. And I said to him, Mike, I said, when we do the review with all the other groups in the company, I want you to do the review. And all I want you to do is walk them through our decision table. And I said, as soon as you start on something, somebody's going to say, but Mike, what if? And then what I want you to do is listen to him carefully and see if you can find the rule that defines his what if. Show him where the rule is and ask him if it'll be okay to defer that until you get to that rule. Well, I must tell you, this was a review that lasted 4 or 5 hours. Excuse me. And what happened was, no sooner he started, somebody said, what if? And he showed them where the rule was, because it was a complete problem space. And what happened is, 5 minutes down the line, somebody else did exactly the same thing, and he responded in exactly the same way. I was sitting, it was an auditorium, and I was sitting up at the back, and he looked up at me and he just grinned, because I told him this is exactly what was going to happen. Well, the third person came up with a what if, and after that we didn't hear a peep out of any of them. They waited until he presented the entire solution, because they knew that no matter what they came up with, he would find the rule and he would deal with it. And I can tell you, this group left there with a, well, we'll see if it'll work, attitude. And we were the only project that was ready to release the thing on time. And we were the only project that didn't have any trouble reports for the next 8 years. So we must have done something right. Well, I'm going to start by considering a particular rule. For instance, I'm interested in what will happen when condition one is alternative two and condition two is no. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, some action has to be executed, and let's go and execute that action. Now, I'm going to concentrate just on that rule, that column. I'm going to say, well, is there anything else that we need to do? And I'm going to put a new action down here. And I'm going to say, yes, we're going to do this action as well. And I'm going to say, is there anything else that we want to do when condition one is alternative two and condition two is no? No, that's it. Okay, so it doesn't matter in what order I do them. So I'm going to go back to action one and say, is there any other situation in which we're going to do action one? And yeah. We're going to do action one here. But we're also going to do something else. We're going to do this. Okay. And at this point, just the act of doing this leads you to realize things. You examine it and you say, wow, you know, whenever condition two is yes, action two will be executed. And what's more, not only will action 2 be executed, but some other action will also be executed. So there's my hypothesis. That whenever condition 2 is yes, actions 2 and 4 are going to be carried out. Now I can test my hypothesis. I can go back to each one of these and examine them and say, are they all really true? That's why I put a question mark, because they're not, it's not cut and, not cast in concrete yet. I need to examine this. My insight was that this always happens. And I found out that, no, that's not really true. Down here, it doesn't happen. Okay. But the rest is good. Okay. I won't go on doing this minutely step by step. This is an abstract thing. We'll get to a real one that you can all tie into, and I'll just fill it out. And you notice I've given them some names at the bottom here. I call them equivalence classes. Why are they equivalence classes? Because they have exactly the same set of actions. If they have the same number, if it's number 0, then it's going to be actions 2, 4, and 5. And sure enough, that's why they're 3 zeros. There are 2 ones, and there are 2, 3, and 4. Well, by just simply changing the shape of my table, I can eliminate all the duplicates. And in my 2.9 million, I can tell you that the number of duplicates was enormous, and we boiled it down in no time to just a few important cases. In fact, it happened to be the solution to a computer problem, and I was working with big supercomputers. And I told everybody that we would test it exhaustively. And they looked at me and they said, 2.9 million conditions on a supercomputer. It took 16 thousandths of a second to do all 2.9 million possibilities, and that was in 1969. Okay, so let's draw our revised table. There it is. Okay, so let's see how we got that. We said if condition two is yes, and this little bar up top here just simply means it's not alternative three, and it is alternative three. So let's go back. See, when it's alternative three and it's condition two yes, is the only time that it's different. The others are all zero. The one oddball is three. So there they are, zero and three. We can check the others as well. Notice that the two that are marked number equivalence class one, both have action four and six. And it's when condition two is no, and it's either alternative one or alternative four. Well, there it is. And so we've reduced this thing down from eight rules to simply five. And believe me, problems just collapse. I can promise you, you get such a good insight to the solution that the problem just collapses. Okay, so let's go on from here and look at a different example. It's always hard to find an example that will be good for all audiences. So I found something that I think most people understand but have never thought about solving. And the problem is to find out if a date is valid in the Gregorian calendar. Now, I know you all think you know what the Gregorian calendar is about. How many of you think the year 1900 was a leap year? It's divisible by four. All right, we'll get back to that. Okay. We'll put the date in, we'll give you three numbers. An integer representing the year, another representing the month, and a third representing the day of the month. Okay, now, it's interesting, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but it's happened to me a million times. I'll go into some computer program, and I can relate a lot of this to computers because that's my field. But I'll go into a program and it'll say, you have an error in this field. Oh, it picks up the error in that field. It says, oh, and now you have an error in that field. I haven't changed that field. Why don't you tell me up front that I had two errors? I don't want to have to redo this 20 times. So, oh, let me just go back here. Okay. So we're going to do some preliminaries here. The years covered by the solution are arbitrarily, we'll go from 1800 to 2050. And we won't have anything but positive numbers, no negative numbers. We'll all, you know, be day 23, month 11, year 1907. There won't be any negative numbers. There won't be year minus 352. No. Okay. And then here is the part that I was just speaking about. We must tell the user every way in which the thing he submitted to us is invalid. And we must tell it to him up front. He submits it, we say, well, your year is bad, the month is impossible, and that day, well, depends on what the month is, but it's no way it can be valid. Okay. So let's start. We can take the first condition. What year is it? And what are the alternatives? Well, there are the alternatives. 0, 1, 2, 3, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's a large number of alternatives. Whoa, hold it, hold it. If we do it that way, remember that it's the size of that problem space is the Cartesian product of all the sets of alternatives. Well, we start off there with a number 2,000 multiplied by 5 multiplied... Whoa, whoa, I've got a headache already. So what should we be looking for? The smallest number of alternatives. Willem van Ockham came up with a concept that's known as Ockham's razor. He was a scholar at Oxford, and he said, in his archaic way, that plurality should not be assumed without necessity, or, if you like, don't make things complicated or even simpler. Keep it simple, stupid. Okay, so let's start again. We can take the year, and this time we can say, well, everything below 1800 we're not interested in. Anything that's between 1800 and 2050, that's good. And anything that's bigger than 2050, we're not interested in. Well, that's just three. Wow, that's an improvement. From 2050-something down to three. Well, this is going to simplify the problem. Okay, how about the month? Well, we can do the same thing with the month. We can say anything less than 1, anything between 1 and 12, and anything bigger than 12. Well, that's just 3, 2. So that's 3, 3. We've got 9 rules so far. How about the day? Well, that depends. I mean, the day we can't tell unless we know what month it is and whether or not it's a leap year in one situation. Okay, so what's a leap year? Well, this is a leap year is a year that has an extra day. And this leap year day comes on February the 29th, as we all know. And in every 400 years, it was necessary to make 97 leap years to keep the calendar in sync with the seasons. Ironically, the guy who invented the algorithm for this whole thing was a librarian in the Vatican Library. His name was Luigi Lilio. Not that that's important, but I've written a paper about that one too. And the rules are simple. Every year, evenly divisible by 400 is a leap year. And all the remaining years that are evenly divisible by 4 and not also evenly divisible by 100 are leap years. And that's how we get 97 in 400 years. And it's very interesting, every one of these 400-year cycles starts on a Wednesday. And it's an exact multiple of 7, which is an interesting fact, but makes things in computers very simple. And in fact, nobody would have a year 2000 problem if they have considered some of these things, because there are very simple representations for dates that are very much more economical than anything anybody uses. But of course, nobody used the right ones. So now we're having this panic. Okay, so let's revise our alternatives. Let's look at the year. Okay, we'll leave that one like it was. The month. Well, if we're clever about how we do this, we can make it. We had, what was it? 14. We had 3 before, okay. But this 3 didn't help us at all. There's a much better partitioning that will help us a lot. What if we say, all those that are less than 1, all those that are 31-day months, all those that are February, and all those that are 30-day months, and then greater than 12. We'll get this down a little bit better in a moment. We just use the numbers for the months to identify the 31-day months and the 30-day months. Now, this partitioning is much more sensible, as we'll see. Now, when I originally did a date routine, this was 1963, I was writing the program and suddenly realized, after analyzing it on one of these tables, that, hey, you've got to get this right. You've got to get these things categorized. And if you get them categorized, everything becomes a lot easier. Well, we'll make some more improvements. How about we have 3? Excuse me. We can do just 2. In range and out of range, where in range is any year inclusive between 1800 and 2500, and out of range, not in range. So now we've got just 2 alternatives. And the month? Well, what we've done here is we've taken the 3 ranges that we're interested in, the 30-day month, February, and then the rest, we've lumped them together. So we end up with just four alternatives. So four times two, that just gives us eight rules so far. Okay. The day, well, we'll see the table. And then the leap year, well, all we have to know is it or is it not a leap year? Okay. So now we're going to make an assumption that the year is okay. Just so that we can explicate the whole thing and understand what it's about, we'll make it simpler. So the month, is it February? Is it a 30-day month? 31-day month, or an invalid month? Well, it turns out, you can see February's got the lion's share of this, because February's the only one that becomes difficult. Well, if the day is between 1 and 28, we don't care, February, all Februarys have 28 days, so that's good. But when it's the 29th, well, then it depends on whether it's a leap year. And all the others, anything else, anything that isn't 1 through 28 or 29 is a mistake. Well, the same thing applies to the 30-day months. 1 through 30 is valid. Anything else is invalid. Same thing with 31-day months. If the number is between 1 and 31, it's a good one. Otherwise, it's no good. Now, if the month is invalid, we can't really tell. We know that every month has at least 28 days. And if the month is wrong, well, 29 to 31 is maybe right, maybe wrong, depends. Anything else is a mistake. And the only time we're interested in the leap year is if it's February the 29th. Now, calculating whether or not it's a leap year takes very little effort. But nevertheless, it takes effort. And in my original solution to this problem, I always calculated whether or not it was a leap year. And it was only when I analyzed it like this that I realized, I don't care if it's a leap year, except on February the 29th. Well, it meant that in most of the situations, I never calculated whether or not it was a leap year. I could have looked it up in a table and said, is it a leap year? But obviously, if I want to extrapolate this out into the future, or I want to keep a calendar going for astronomical purposes, this can make a very big table. It's much easier to calculate it very quickly. And ironically, the numbers that we're trying to find it as a multiple of, when you use it in a computer, are very simple to examine and decide whether they're multiples of 400. The binary version of everything that's a multiple of 4 ends in 00. Well, so it's very simple to look at the number and say, oh, yeah, that's a multiple of 4. Anyhow, that's an aside. So here we have the four situations that are valid dates. If it's February, it's between 1 and 28, it's a valid date. If it's February 29th, then it's a leap year, it's a valid date. If it's a 30-day month, it's between 1 and 30, the day is, then it's a valid date. Everything else is a mistake. But what about letting the user know what's wrong? We haven't dealt with that. Okay, so now let's look at the whole solution for determining whether a date is correct. There it is. This time I've added the two parts, when it's in range we've looked at, and out of range. And if you notice, there are our four valid dates. And in this case, it's invalid because all of them have a year error. The year is out of range. And in this case, they all have a month error, because the month is just simply invalid. And in this case here, it's not a leap year, and it's February the 29th, sorry about that. And that's why it's an error. This is an error. Now these here are maybe an error. What happens is, the month is invalid, and the number is between 29 and 31, the day number is between 29 and 31. So since we don't know what the month is, it's maybe a day error. But now the user can get a complete description of what his problem is. He submits a date, and we say, well, it's invalid because you've made a mistake in the year, and you've made a mistake in the, let's take this one here, for instance, and the date. And it can also say you possibly have a mistake in the day in any one of these three situations. Okay, so there we have the whole solution to determining whether a date is valid in the Gregorian calendar, and we also have the whole solution to telling the user under what condition, what the problem is with what he submitted. Okay. I'm going to show you just a little bit, a glimpse into what I call elaboration. You can elaborate either an action or a condition. Now, what do I mean by elaborate? Well, obviously, you cannot solve very large problems on a little piece of paper like this. I will tell you that I once claimed that I could do the overall solution to any problem on an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper. And one of my colleagues was in the audience, and she said just loud enough for everybody to hear, boy, he writes small. Well, I have yet to find a problem that I can't, in a readable form, put on an 8.5 inch by 11 inch piece of paper. But that means that there are some problems that need resolving. For instance, we could look at the leap year and say, how do we do that? Well, this simply says, is it an even multiple of 400? And if the answer is, yes, it is an even multiple of 400, then we know it's a leap year. And so then what we want to do is we want to look at whether it's an even multiple of 100. And we don't care here, because we've already determined that it's a leap year. We do care here. And so here we've determined that it isn't a leap year. If it's an even multiple of 100, but not an even multiple of 400, then it's not a leap year. And the last thing we have to do is say, is it an even multiple of 4? So we have over here, let's see, oops. I'm getting this one button, I'm just holding it there. And there is our elaboration. Now the interesting thing is that an elaboration of a condition can only have one action. And the action simply spells out which of the set of alternatives it is. And the set of alternatives for leap year was just yes and no. So every rule in this elaboration must end up with a yes or no. However, the elaboration of an action can be a sheet every bit as complicated as the original one. And if you'd like to come and have a look at them afterwards, I'll show you some of those. Okay, so how do we solve problems? Ironically, there's no recipe, there's no formula, there's no piece of software. It's ultimately up to you. You have to lay out your problem space. You have to find all the conditions that affect what it is you do to solve the problem. You have to make your table with all the bits and pieces in. You have to ensure that you've omitted nothing and that everything is exhausted and that everything is a proper partition. It's up to you. There are things that you can do. My group of people in a particular company, we decided we could write a piece of software to do this. And we thought it was foolproof, and we wrote this piece of software, and we were thrilled with the result. And we gave it to our first user community, and they proved us wrong. It was anything but foolproof. They proved what a mess you could make very quickly, no matter how well a piece of software worked for people who used it properly. But the average user was totally incapable of using this piece of software. And so we decided that maybe we'd defer this. In fact, I had a phone call from one of the people involved a few months ago, and he said to me, "Henry, I think I could now build a foolproof piece of software." And I said, "Steve, if you can, go for it. You'll make a fortune." I'm still convinced that it's not easy to do. Not unless people understand what the goals are and how to go about it. And it requires practice. It's like any skill. I have all kinds of, in fact, a bunch of us authored a book about this, which unfortunately is out of print and not readily accessible. And we describe all the idiosyncratic bits and pieces of how to go about doing these things. Rules must be mutually exclusive. Alternatives must be exhaustive. And then finally, focus. When you're trying to write the solution, you've got to blot out everything about the problem space except the rule you're working on, being confident that somewhere along the line you're going to do them all. You know, they say you can only juggle 6 or 7 things in your head at a time. This makes that juggling act much, much simpler. Instead of worrying about, well, what if and what if and what if, you get away with saying, I know I'm going to deal with those, I can forget about the what ifs, and I can go down the line and do this one thing. You must deal with the entire problem space. A lot of people say, well, that can never happen, we can leave that out, forget it. No, you must consider all the bits and pieces. All your what ifs will be dealt with if the problem space was properly defined. Now, everybody, I was put in charge of a project in 1974, and everybody was told that they would be required to produce tables of this form. And everybody produced the tables because they were required to produce the tables, but they didn't do them right. And they actually solved the problem and then tried to make a table fit their solution. And that didn't work. So, my experience has been very simple. Here's my pie. And my pie is associated with computer solutions to problems. So there are two pieces here that are just the computer solution. But building the tables takes the lion's share of the time. I had a general manager of the division in the company I worked for come to me and say, "Henry, we're 6 months into a 9-month project and none of your people have used 1 minute of computer time. What the hell are you doing?" And I said, "We're building tables." And he said, "Well, that's not going to get the product out the door." We got the product out the door on time, under budget. You have to document the solution. You have to draw all your tables, and I'll show you some, so that you can see that they're really pretty comprehensive. And then with the computer, you have to code it and debug it. And I can tell you that every time I work with people right now, and I don't have control over the thing, the first thing they do is they start coding. And I say, "What are you doing? You haven't even thought about the problem yet." And they do it piecemeal. They just go at it. And then they wonder why it doesn't do the job. I can tell you, I come out of these things with a tremendously high level of confidence that my solution is going to work. The proof of the pudding, I guess, is in the eating. It did look like a pudding, didn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you. That's it.
Would you like to entertain any questions?
Yes, I'll entertain any questions.
Yes.
You had in the main table this category invalid month, and I'm really bothered.
What if somebody gives me a month and says it's month 29? Have you ever heard of a month 29?
No.
But people will do that.
Oh. So
that's all positive integers.
So, okay. So that's the
that's
exhaustive
an
alternative.
Time.
Okay.
Yes.
Even though you know there is no such thing.
I'll go even further. Have you had error messages on your computer that say,
You're out of disk space?
90% of the time it's rubbish. 90% of the time it's rubbish. What it is somebody's detected a problem, and the only alternative we have is one of these messages, and he throws it up on the screen. And it's erroneous and it's misleading. You must deal as explicitly with errors as you deal with non-errors. So for instance, if I tell you you have an invalid month, that's what you have. I don't just say, oh, your date's wrong. There's nothing more frustrating than computer system messages to me. And I have a whole book full of them that are totally erroneous. And they're done because somebody doesn't think these messages are important. No, they're very important. That interface with the user is as important as getting the solution to the problem right. Any more?
You said it's very important to define your problem space. When you know that you've got everything.
Yes.
Okay. The process of drawing one of these tables is the stimulus to your intuition. You will draw up this table and then you'll look at it and say, you know, there's another condition that we haven't considered. And immediately you have to populate your table with that condition. And I'll tell you how I do it. I start in the top left-hand corner and I start drawing a table. And then I get one of these insights and I stop. And I used to write myself a cryptic note on the table I was busy with, explaining why I stopped. And I found out, don't write a cryptic note, write a very full note about why you stopped. Because if you don't, when you try and reconstruct it later, you won't know why you did it. And so I would start, and I'd number the sheet. I'd number it 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'd put a date on it. And every time I stop, because I had one of these insights, and let me tell you, when you have a complete problem space, you know you've got a complete problem space. Boy, do you know it. It feels good. I'll show you some, and you'll get the picture. Brilliant mind, and he came one day and asked how he could have access to this. And I told him. And then, just out of curiosity, I went to have a look at what he did. He is the only person who made one path through the whole thing without backtracking at all. And it told me everything I needed to know, not only about my program, but about him. I have other people who would go round and round and round someplace, not quite getting it. And if a lot of people did that, then I rewrote the script describing what the task was. And I kept on doing this until very few people, or at least there was just one individual who maybe got stuck in there. But if I found everybody was stuck in something, then I knew I had described it badly, so I would revise it. And when Jim Thornton went through this thing, and he just went, like a knife through butter, he just went right through the thing, never backtracked once, and got right to the end of the exercise. Well, I had a very good relationship with him anyway.
I think it's
a very necessary part, especially in computer software. I will tell you that I left the company for whom I did a lot of this, and I had a Hungarian friend who took over maintenance of all my stuff when I left, and I used to phone him every 6 months to find out any problems had cropped up. He had the best job in the business. He could do whatever he wanted. Nothing ever happened to the modules he was responsible for. He never had to change one line of code. And that was not something that was just another program. It was the heart of the operating system of a supercomputer, and it was being invoked thousands of times per second. It had to be very robust, and it was. Any more questions? I'll be glad to show you some tables and some of the resulting things from them. They're probably good, but they show you the complexity that can be handled.
I have one question.
Yes.
Maybe it doesn't make sense, but if there is an answer, would it be better to start at one end than the other? You have a certain number of outcomes that can happen, the actions that can happen. Let's say that number is X, and you have a certain number of conditions that can get you to those actions. If you call that Y, is it better to start with the smaller end, the bigger end?
I actually addressed that in the paper that is available here. It turns out that there are no blocks here. And in fact, don't worry about covering the whole problem. Just start. Because remember, you can commute it, and you can change the order, and you can do anything you want post facto. But just start.
But it's not going to be much shorter from one end to the other?
No. In fact, you'll know what's important, and you'll put those on your first list. But it's, you might find very important ones that you never even considered. But they'll come out later. And when they come out, you'll recognize their significance, and you'll change the order of things, and you'll fix it up. I have known no other mechanism that doesn't block you. This doesn't block you. In some respects, I guess I've been told I'm somewhat of a perfectionist, but I've never had a problem starting one of these tables. And it's incredible how quickly they grow, because just the act of putting it down and starting to work with it is stimulating you. And frankly, I don't get my best things done while I'm drawing these pieces of paper. I get my best thing, but I've worried the problem. I'm not Newton, and I'm not worried about gravity, but I have worried the problem, and if I've worried the problem, I know my intuition will come through. I haven't worried the problem. I'm not expecting anything either.
For example, when I'm trying to place students and figuring out we had certain criteria. We know their placement score on the written part and the oral part and all the different parts, that enters into it. Whether they're an undergrad or a grad student enters into it, maybe PhD.
Yeah, but
and
the actual possible placements may be fewer. The outcomes may be fewer than the variables going in. So my question was, do we start with all the possible combinations of classes a person could take? Because that number is probably smaller than all of the...
We had some categories in mind, and all of a sudden today a new one came up, the major. What the student will need to know for their major, for their particular major. That's yet another category.
These kind of tables are all in our placement packet.
So if we were doing
high heavy writing, low writing.
So if we were doing that kind of a table, we would actually create one column that would say maybe courses that we don't have to offer simply because that would account for errors.
You'd enumerate them and then you do a little taxonomy like I did, for instance. I did a taxonomy of the month.
That would make sense, yeah.
I said that there are